All right, welcome back to the podcast, and we are approaching Memorial Day, start of the summer. That means, what, 3 months to Labor Day? 3 months, 3 months. That's enough time to do just about anything. And if you've been listening to this thing, you know that I sometimes struggle with my weight, and that has not changed, unfortunately. I have eliminated candy and all that junk, but doesn't mean I'm not eating bananas all the time, and it's like eating a half a loaf of bread. And so I've got a few issues, and you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pray for a little assistance here, because every time I try to do something totally on my own, I may or may not get it done, and I'll be exhausted, and it'll seem like the hardest thing in the world. And if you ask for a little bit of guidance or a little bit of assistance from the Lord, guess what? It can be. Look, he works in all kinds of mysterious ways. Oops, what's this? But I had a little challenge this week, and I asked him for help, and he granted it big time. And should I tell you what I was dealing with? Temptation. Yeah, it was a certain level of temptation. I don't want to get into the details, but everybody is faced with that from time to time. I did not give in, but I struggled more than I probably should have. And I was struggling, and then finally I just asked for the Lord's help. And it evaporated. It just dissolved. Pretty interesting. And then a couple of days go by, and you can revert real quickly and think that you can do it. I think that I can do it, and really can't. I need him every step of the way. Is that a little much? Is that a little much for a podcast? I don't know. But there it is. Anyway, had a great talk this week with Madeline Westerhout. Madeline was, as you may know, senior assistant, top assistant to Donald Trump in the White House. He was at his right side all the time, handling virtually all of his affairs, his appointments, his correspondence. She was the woman you had to see if you wanted to see the president. It seemed like her influence, her power, her visibility was potentially just as great as a chief of staffs. I don't know. Very impressive person. People noticed her during the transition when she would walk prospective cabinet appointments to the administration through Trump Tower. People were kind of wondering about her and speculating about her. Madeline got this plum job when she was just, 26 years old. Had worked in politics for a couple of years in Washington, D.C. at the Republican National Committee. Donald Trump shocks the world, including the Republican National Committee, by actually winning the thing. And the rest is history. Well, it's still being written. Madeline had that top job, became, it seems, quite close to the president, but then made a big mistake and revealed information about the president, things that he may have said in private. She relayed those to some reporters. That became public, and she was fired. She was terminated. But I remember this episode well. I remember how honestly the president spoke, that, you know, this kind of hurt his feelings, that these were hurtful things that were said. How have you heard the president say that? I don't think I'd ever heard him say that his feelings were hurt. And he did hear words to that effect. She offered, I thought, such a heartfelt, pure apology. And I could feel her pain, and I could feel her genuine regret. She went on to write a book about the experience. It's called Off the Record, My Dream Job at the White House, How I Lost It, and What I Learned, which I think is a beautiful title, by the way. It's taking some bad situation and truly learning from it and growing from it. And I think that's what happened here. When this book came out, I was really pleased to see that the president, President Trump, you know, endorsed it. And I think he put out a tweet about it and said one or two things about it publicly, and he didn't have to do that, particularly for an aide that he fired. But he's a very unique person, and I think he has genuine affection for her. I know he does. So Madeline is now living in California. She's 30 years old, and this book is has been out for almost a year. I have not read the book. I'm about to, based on this conversation. You know, I used to read the book before I sat down with somebody because I just wanted to convince them how much I knew and how, yes, I read the book. But think about it. If you go up to some couple of people at a party and they're all talking about a book that you haven't read, you're not going to hang around for that conversation very long, right? It's kind of silly to read the book ahead of time if you're interviewing somebody in front of people. Some may disagree. Terry Gross is on NPR. Some people are crazy about her. She does that, and or at least she did that in some of the interviews I heard. And it's like, what the hell are these two people talking about? So I didn't read the book, but I want to now. Here is my conversation with Madeline Westerhout. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Orange County, California.
Tell me about your family, your background, and only child. Did you have brothers and sisters?
My family, I have a younger sister. We're 16 months apart. My parents were divorced when I was about 4 years old. But, you know, actually, as I have grown up, I am honestly really thankful for the relationships that I was able to build with both of my parents. I feel like I have relationships with both of them, like as individual human beings. So as much as, you know, that having divorced parents is very unfortunate, it really allowed me to build great relationships with my parents and my grandparents too. So I am very close with my family and really excited to be back in Orange County after about 11 years on the East Coast.
Your parents divorced, I understand, but what did each of them do for a living?
So my mom she just retired. She worked for a pharmaceutical company called Allergan for about 20 years as a practice consultant in her final position there. And then my dad also is in the medical field working for a company called Dräger that makes anesthesia machines. So he has been very busy this past year.
And let's see, politics. Were you interested as a kid ever? Was it something that intrigued you?
It really wasn't something that intrigued me until junior and senior year of high school. That was in the 2008 election. And all of my friends were supporting Barack Obama. Half of them couldn't even vote because we were only 17. And I supported McCain. I think that was like the beginning of my kind of not rebellious stage, but kind of going against the grain. I was in the Young Republicans Club in high school. I think we had about four members, and our t-shirts on the front said McCain Palin, on the back said No Obama. And I actually was able to vote in that election, and I did vote for Senator McCain.
But you were the outlier in a way. I thought Orange County, I guess it's changed, but traditionally it was considered like that's Republican territory. It was for a long
definitely.
Time.
Definitely. And I think, you know, adults were more conservative, but teenagers, especially now, you know, I'm not really sure what it is, but Obama was all for hope and change, and he was friendly with celebrities, and that was just cool. And so a lot of my friends were big fans of Obama.
And was there anything about McCain in terms of, was it more of a countercultural thing for you, or was there something about policy, or, you know, for me, it was personality. I mean, really, there was something I liked about Nixon when I just thought mm-hmm. he was a nice man. And some people make that's kind of what was my first political impression. Richard Nixon is a nice man. Was there anything personal, or was it policy oriented, or just that you weren't that intrigued with Obama?
Well, definitely that I was not intrigued with Obama, but also I loved that Senator McCain had experience serving in more ways than one. He was a supporter of the military, and, you know, I honestly just thought he was better qualified for the position.
So, okay, junior, senior, and then where did you go to college?
I went to college in South Carolina at a school called the College of Charleston. and it was amazing. I loved my college experience.
Is that like a arts-oriented school?
Not really. It's a small liberal arts school, but not really arts
What did you
based.
major in?
I majored in political science. I actually, funny story, my major was psychology. I wanted to be a clinical psychologist. And then I think the summer between my sophomore and junior year, I read Decision Points by President George W. Bush. And I came back to school that next semester and enrolled in, I think it was a very basic American history class. And then after that, changed my major to poli-sci because I thought President Bush was a good, decent man, and I wanted to get involved in politics.
Very cool. So, all right, you wrap up at the College of Charles. And by the way, you just said it was a great experience. Was it like socially, academically, all of it? What was so special about it?
Pretty much all throughout high school, I knew I wanted to leave California, and that's so hard for people to understand because so many people, want to come to California and our great weather and it's a beautiful state. But I really wanted to explore a different part of our country. And so I didn't apply to any schools in California, actually. I applied to different schools all over the country and was visiting Charleston and just really fell in love with the city. I mean, the city of Charleston, if you haven't been, or if any of if the listeners haven't been, go visit Charleston. It is a beautiful city and just a city with so much history. And so it was a great place to go to school. It was safe. It was fun. We had the beach, but we were in the city. And I feel like I got a good education, but I also got a great education outside of the classroom.
I have been there. I was very, very impressed, and I had boiled peanuts for the first time. Did you ever have those? Yeah, that's.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, yes, because they're everywhere, but I'm not a big fan. This
Yeah,
consistency kind of freaks me out.
truth be told, I don't think I liked them all that much either, but I definitely had them, and I remember where I was when I had them. So, all right, you get out of college, you graduate, and what year is that?
2013.
2013. What's your first move?
Moved to DC right away. I had an internship on Capitol Hill with the congressman who represented my district from home. So it was a congressman, John Campbell, and I interned for him for about 5 or 6 weeks while I was looking for a job. And I really did think I wanted to work on the Hill, but honestly, after a couple weeks on the Hill, I was really bored. So I was fortunate enough to be hired at the Republican National Committee.
And let's see, when you decide, okay, I'm going to Washington, D.C., I'm going to look for a job, is there an end game? Do you have an idea in your mind what you want? Do you want to be president someday? Do you want to be a press secretary? Do you want to be, is there a life's plan here?
So when I was writing my book, Off the Record, my mom reminded me, and I have no recollection of this, but my mom told me that after I graduated, I told her, I'm going to go to Washington, learn everything I need to know, and then I'm going to run for president. And I don't really remember saying that at all, but she remembers it very clearly. So I guess my goal was to be president, which I think is, I think is not a usual goal for a 23-year-old. When you're seven, that's cute and funny, but I was very serious, apparently.
And well, hey, it's not off the table. It's really not.
It's
So,
not.
all right. So you, I'm sorry. You ultimately got a job at the RNC, you said?
Yes.
What was your title there?
My title was executive assistant to the finance director, who at that time was Katie Walsh, who then became the chief of staff in the 2015-2016 cycle.
And what's your impression of it? Well, number one, why were you bored on Capitol Hill working in the congressman's office? Just because an intern and you didn't get that much to do, or what was it?
I, looking back, it had to have been just that they didn't really have enough for interns to do. So I actually spent a lot of my time giving tours of the Capitol, which I really enjoyed because being able to show and share with constituents, the Capitol building was really fun, and learning about that. I mean, we had to go through classes and really study up on what we were sharing. And so that was really special. So I definitely enjoyed that. But yeah, sitting behind my desk, answering the phone and listening to constituents complaining about this or that was not my cup of tea.
You know, it's funny. We don't have interns where I work right now, and I actually think that's great. I've been in a lot of companies where they have interns, and I notice after about 3 or 4 days or 2 weeks or whatever, they get bored. They're on their phones, and potentially it turns them off to what could be a pretty cool career. But there isn't enough for them to do. It's very hard to integrate somebody into an office environment when they have no responsibility and you can't really blame them for anything or really count on them for anything, you know? So it's just a weird dynamic. All right, so RNC, and you're an assistant to Katie Walsh. Are you loving it? Are you inhaling politics? What's your reaction? How are you feeling about it all?
I really did enjoy my 4 years at the RNC. So 2 years in the finance department, so major donors, fundraising, which was interesting. And it's funny because I was a really, really shy teenager. And the thought of picking up the phone to cold call like a major donor gave me so much anxiety. But as I grew, that definitely didn't bother me anymore. By the time I left the White House, I was picking up the phone and I'm calling anybody and everybody. So yeah, I think I learned a lot in those 4 years. It was a really fun environment, a really close-knit team. You know, I feel like we went through, the team that I worked with at the RNC, we went through a lot together. I mean, working in a presidential cycle is something else. And so you really bond with those people. And some of them are still my closest friends. But yeah, I did enjoy the work for sure.
And I'm sorry, that presidential cycle is the 2016 president. That's your first one.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you work with Sean Spicer?
I did. Yes. Sean is a good friend. Yeah. Know Sean very well. I used to babysit his kids actually.
So, and while you're there, I would take it, I guess that the media were writing about you from time to time, not you personally, but the RNC, what you're doing. Are they number one?
Oh, definitely.
And did you notice, did they get it right? Did they get it wrong? Were they, how would you characterize the coverage?
To be honest, I don't remember as much about what they wrote about the RNC specifically, but just that 2015-2016 cycle was crazy. You know, we had I think 16 candidates. And I will say that I think Reince did a very good job of providing every single campaign with the equal amount of support, infrastructure, money, information. And so we were really working for 16 different people and interacting with their teams. But of course, you know, the press liked to say that the RNC was supporting Jeb Bush or supporting Marco Rubio. And I think that's just not fair or true, because I remember Ryan saying, you as an individual working at the RNC, you can support whoever you want, but none of that goes on your social media. None of that, you know, you can't have yard signs for a candidate in your yard. And until we have a nominee, the party is neutral.
So what does the RNC do, like, for 16 different candidates? Like, how does that actually work? What are you providing the campaigns that they can't provide for themselves?
So after the 2012 election, you know, the RNC really was very introspective and looked at everything that we could have done better. And so we spent a lot of money on data and building that infrastructure to make sure that whoever our candidate was in 2016 would be as prepared as possible to win. And so the RNC provided every single candidate, you know, a major list of voter data. And in my job at that time, Katie Walsh was the chief of staff, so I was her assistant. And we went to all of the debates, all of the primary debates. I believe there were 9. And I was kind of the liaison to all of the candidates at the debates. So whatever they needed in their green rooms from, you know, I think Bush's team always asked for a big bowl of ice, and Trump's team always asked for Diet Cokes. And You know, just little things like that. But that was really fun for me as a 25-year-old to kind of get up close and personal with all these different people, one of which could potentially be the president of the United States.
So when it comes to voter records, like, does that help them in the primary, or would that just, is that geared toward, hey, look, if you get the nomination, you may need this stuff. Is this general election stuff? Is this stuff to help them in the primary? Do you know?
I think a little bit of both. You know, to be honest, that's not my expertise. And data is something that has always been something that kind of goes over my head. So I know that the RNC provided each campaign, you know, voter records and you know helped each campaign identify who to target and who to reach out to and who are the Republicans, the strong R's, who are leaning R's. And then whenever, you know, whoever became the nominee, which of course in 2016 it was Mr. Trump, the RNC and that campaign would team up, join forces, and make sure that we had everything in place in order to win the election.
And forgive me if any of this overlaps with the book or is in the book, just feel free to point that out as I, because as I mentioned, but look, so you were at those debates, which were wild. I mean, let's face it,
Wild.
they were totally wild. The one that, there was the Megyn Kelly moment, which was
Yeah.
extraordinary. And were you there for that?
I was. Yes, that was Cleveland, I think. I think that was the first debate because Cleveland was where we were having the 2016 Republican National Convention. And so we wanted to have the first debate at the Q Arena. And yeah, I remember that. That was an interesting
It
moment
was
for sure.
August of 2015, and I thought it was fantastic for Trump and fantastic for Megyn Kelly. I thought they were both like at the top of their game. I just thought it was, but like, and then there was the other memorable one was the I think the Valentine's Day one in South Carolina in February. But I guess my question to you was, and I know you guys have to be neutral, but was the RNC like kind of freaking out about Trump and what this guy seems he's totally out of control. I mean, I'm eating it up. I love it, but if I'm at the RNC, I don't know. What was that like?
I think, you know, to be honest, and I talk about this in my book, but I was a fan of someone like Marco Rubio. You know, the reason I got into politics was because I read President Bush's book. And so I kind of liked that more traditional candidate. And so I personally, in the beginning, favored Marco Rubio. And I think in the very, very early stages of the cycle, you know, I think a lot of people thought that Trump would burn out or that this wouldn't last. And so when he continued to be center stage every single debate over and over again, others started dropping out. It was like, wow, no, this is serious. This is real. And he could win this thing. He could be our nominee and he could win this thing. So yeah, really, really interesting kind of how that progressed.
So, all right, he wins it, and it becomes apparent he's going to win. Maybe what in April or May, and from the outside looking in, we're looking at people like Reince Priebus, and the word is, I don't know if it's accurate or not, but there's panic, and there's just like this realization or this sense that Trump can't win; he'll be slaughtered by Hillary. Is that real? Is that does that is that character is that accurate?
I don't think so. I think no, I think the RNC and the Trump campaign really did work well together. Of course, you know, there are growing pains and the Trump campaign are the quote unquote outsiders and the RNC is the establishment. And so, you know, there's all these stories about drama and infighting, but at the end of the day, the Republican National Committee wants to elect a Republican. And so once we nominate Mr. Trump as the Republican nominee, it's full steam ahead. Like, let's get this guy elected.
Did your duties change that once Trump became the apparent nominee? Did your job evolve, or is it the same?
A little bit. We spent a lot of time in New York, working closely with senior members of the Trump campaign, so a lot of time in Trump Tower. I would travel up there with Katie and Reince. But I was still, my main focus was supporting Katie and making sure Katie and Reince had everything they needed to support Mr. Trump.
By the way, what was Trump Tower like in those days? I've heard varying accounts that, you know, it was bare bones, hardly anybody was there, chaotic, or how would you?
I honestly don't remember if this story is in my book, but I'll tell it because it's one of my favorite Trump Tower stories. We were up there and Katie was preparing for a big, big presentation to senior members of the campaign. And we had put together this beautiful PowerPoint presentation, really intricate, and we were really proud of it. And there was no like industrial sized printer on the campaign floor. And then we couldn't, you know, go to any of the other floors because it was the Trump organization. And so I was just like, oh my gosh, I have to print this 30 page doc. I have to print 20 copies of this 30 page document. And we were printing it on like a little, you know, little printer that you buy for your home office at Kink or at Max or whatever. And I was just like, I cannot believe what's going on right now. That was funny. So yeah, it was definitely, I wouldn't say bare bones, but it didn't, when you walked in, it was kind of like, wow, this is a presidential campaign. But they did it. They made it work, obviously. We all know how it turns out. And so I give them a lot of credit. They were, they knew what was important, which was the base and the support and the enthusiasm of the candidate.
When did you first meet Donald Trump?
I didn't meet him until after the election. And I do also share this in my book, but I did not vote for President Trump. And I called him a couple days before my book came out last summer to let him know that this was coming out. And I told him, you know, sir, I want to make you aware of this. It's in my book, but I didn't vote for you. And the reason is because I believed everything that the, you know, now we call it the fake news media, but everything that the media told me about him. I was 26 years old and I didn't love the way he spoke about women or, you know, he was perceived to speak about women. And, you know, I just wasn't a big fan. And so I didn't vote for him. And then he won. And I went up to New York it was the Saturday after the election. And we were in Trump Tower and took the motorcade out to Bedminster. And the president-elect at that point had a small intimate dinner with his very senior staff. And it was really like the celebration victory dinner. And I was standing in the corner of the room, making sure that Reince and Katie, you know, were settled and they were all good. And then I heard a very familiar voice say, come over and join us. And I looked around and I was the only person in the room. And I was like, oh my gosh, she's talking to me. And he had just invited me to join this dinner. And so I sat at dinner with him for about 2 hours. And he was so charismatic, hilariously funny. And just so kind. Even I really noticed the way he treated the wait staff and the way he treated his dinner companions and making sure that they were happy and that the food was good. And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, I have been so wrong about this man. And I have really judged a book by its cover. And I was wrong.
So did you think in any way, did it affect your work? You know, you're working for a guy that you're not intending to vote for, or he's turning you off every step of the way. And that would be a totally human thing. Not, you know, maybe imperceptibly. And first, yeah, let me ask you that. Do you think it did? Would you have been more enthusiastic or more diligent? And I know you were diligent. I know you did your job, but you know what I mean? Did it impact you in a slight way?
To be honest, no, because I really loved working for Katie and for Reince and for the party. And so I wanted to make sure that they had what they needed in order to be successful at their jobs. And so it wasn't there was no like secret, like, let's try to make sure he loses or anything like that. I really respected the people that I was working directly for and wanted to make sure that they were well represented.
And they had no, you sensed, well, did you? I mean, you couldn't have been the only one who had doubts about this guy. You know,
well, like I said, I mean, yeah, I think in any organization, there's differences of opinion. And so I think it's very natural to have people that originally supported Kasich or Carly Fiorina or Ben Carson. But like I said, kind of at the beginning, like I really do think that Reince did a good job making sure that the staff was aware that he is our nominee. Like now when he became the nominee, Trump is our nominee and we're full steam ahead.
What was it like when the Access Hollywood tape came out?
That was tough for sure. Especially for me as a young woman, you know, I didn't really know what to think. And so, yeah, I think it's universally agreed upon that that was a difficult couple of days, in the campaign.
Do you write about it?
I do in my book. Yes. I just wrote that it was difficult and I didn't really know what to think. Yeah.
Did everybody think it was, I mean, there was a sense that at least that Saturday, I think Friday into Saturday, that the campaign was over. I saw reports. I've never met Reince Priebus, by the way, and I've never met Katie Walsh. But I've heard that they, at least Reince, went to Trump Tower and told him, it's over, you got to drop out.
I wasn't privy to those conversations. And so if that did happen, I was one, not in the room, and two, you know, was not made aware of the fact afterwards. So I can't really speak to that. But at some point, even if that is true, at some point, everyone got over it because we won and we worked closely together and Reince became the chief of staff.
And one thing, when did things change? Like it was a very depressing weekend. The debate, I think, was that Sunday night, the town hall debate. Mm-hmm. And I think Trump did some really brilliant things, like having those women there, which at first I found that like kind of, I couldn't believe he was doing it. I thought it was just awful. But I realized that I think it was a message to Hillary. Mm-hmm. It wasn't to the national audience. It was, Hillary, if you go there, I'm going right to them. Now, he did go to them anyway, but he could have used them, I think. He could have used them even more. He could have talked about it even more than he did. And do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think, you know, the kind of the black cloud over that whole situation, I don't think it lasted too long. I mean, maybe a week. But then it was, we were back at it and we were ready to work together.
So, one thing my wife pointed out about that tape, which I did not notice, and I never heard anyone else say it. She's the only person who noticed this. Although later I read it in an Ann Coulter book. So he says, you know, when you're a star, they let you do anything, grab them, you know, but the mm-hmm. thing that she picked up on, let you mm-hmm. consent. Mm-hmm. And whenever yeah. anyone said in the media that this was him boasting about sexually assaulting women, that's really not true. And
right.
I just thought that was kind of a fascinating observation that I have not heard anywhere other than Ann Coulter. And I found that out like 2 years ago. Did you notice that? I mean, is that, did you ever hear that before?
I haven't heard that, but that makes sense. And it's interesting because as I got to know President Trump better and better, the one thing that I continue to tell people over and over about him is how much he respects women, which is ironic for me because that was one of the things that kind of turned me off about him is, you know, I don't know if he respects women. And as I got to really know him and work with him, he absolutely does. And I will go to my grave saying that.
So you guys win. It's amazing. You have that dinner at Bedminster. When do you find out what you're going to do in the White House?
So the transition period, the time between the election and the inauguration, I was in Trump Tower most of the time, and President Trump was doing all of his cabinet secretary and senior staff level interviews. And so my job at that time was to make sure that these interviews were scheduled and everyone had the logistics needed. And I mean, you have to remember, it's not just like, come to the office tomorrow. It's like, come to Trump Tower that's surrounded by security and Secret Service, and we need your vitals. And, you know, it was not an easy thing for an individual to get into Trump Tower or Mar-a-Lago or Bedminster. And so I remember sending out one of the first email confirmations for one of the first meetings that the president-elect was going to have. And I said in my email, you know, your meeting is Monday at noon, and I will meet you on the corner of, I believe it was 57th and 5th Avenue, the Tiffany's corner. So I'll meet you downstairs on the corner of Trump Tower, and I'll escort you inside the building. And so that kind of became my go-to, because I wanted to make sure that no one got lost, and that the people that were coming in to meet with the president-elect for what could potentially be the most important interview of their life were well taken care of. And the press pool, there was a press pool in the lobby of Trump Tower, and they started kind of realizing that when I walked back and forth from the elevator to the door, you know, someone was coming in. And so I got this title or, you know, nickname of greeter girl or elevator girl. And one afternoon, Katie said to me, you know, the president-elect wants to see you. I was like, the president-elect has no idea who I am. What do you mean he wants to see me? And he had literally like been watching the news and seen me walking in, you know, an individual into the lobby, and thought that that was a nice touch, and wanted to tell me that he was proud of me and that I was doing a nice job, which was just for him to take the time out of his day to call up a 26-year-old, you know, kid and tell him they were doing a great job was just the most, you know, incredible feeling. And so I, for those several months, I thought that I was just going to go into the White House and be Katie's assistant still. You know, whatever job she was going to get, I was going to be her assistant. And one day she said to me, how do you feel about sitting outside of the Oval Office? And I was like, yeah, I feel good about that. I don't really know what you mean, but sure. And that was kind of that. We had some conversations about what my title would be. We decided on executive assistant to the president, and that was that. I never like interviewed for the position. I never put my resume in. It was just kind of, do you want to do this? Yeah, okay. The president-elect thinks it's a good idea too, and so does Reince and Jared and Bannon, and let's do it.
So that's totally cool, by the way. Was that your idea to meet them at 57th and 5th? I mean,
it was.
It's very impressive. I love that level of attention to detail. It's just a...
Which is, yeah, and at the time, I honestly had no clue. I didn't have any, you know, master plan of this is going to get me some job. I really was just thinking about, like, if I'm coming in to meet with the president-elect and it's the middle of Manhattan and it's crazy busy and you're probably super stressed already, how am I going to make this as easy as possible for the individual coming in? So there was no like ulterior motive. I wish I was that, you know, that calculating.
No, it's just great. It really, and now I can really understand why Trump sensed your quality, your ability. That is, it's unusual. And getting into a building, by the way, is a pain in the neck. It can be.
Yeah.
You don't know where to go. You know, there are multiple entrances. There are just, anyway, I just love that attention to detail. So when do you pause? I mean, you are 26. I mean, I guess it's gradual. You have the transition. You have, then you, suddenly you get this title. I don't know. What are your parents? How are they reacting? How are they, your family, your friends? I mean, you are seeing the president of the United States every single day.
Yeah. it was crazy. And it was, you know, my parents and my family were obviously so proud, and I was able to bring my parents and my sister to inauguration. And so the four of us went to inauguration together, which was really special for me, to be able to share that with them. And, you know, we went to the inauguration balls, and then that was, so that was a Friday. And then that next Saturday I went right into work. And, you know, walking into the White House never gets old. Walking into the Oval Office to your desk, walking into the outer oval right outside of the Oval Office to your desk really never gets old. And so those first few weeks were really just a blur of like, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe I'm here. But also we have a government to build and to run, and there's no, you know, there's no downtime. There's no like, let's get to work. And that was definitely the posture of President Trump was, I'm sworn in at 12 o'clock and it's time to get to work.
Did you have a tip? First of all, let me just get this out of the way. You obviously rode on Air Force One numerous times.
I did. Yes. I remember the first time I rode on Air Force One was in March of 2017, when the president was going down to Mar-a-Lago for the RNC retreat, okay. The RNC meeting. And so that was my first time on Air Force One and
Marine One too.
Marine One. Yes. I was fortunate enough to travel on Marine One a couple of times, which is pretty much the coolest thing. I'd never been on a helicopter before. In Marine One, I mean, it's really cool. There's no other, I don't know how else to say other than it's really, really cool.
Did you feel, you know, you've had some training now, your RNC work and everything else, ready for the job, ready to be the assistant to the president? Did you feel well equipped? Was there still a learning curve for you? And did you have to spend a lot of time figuring him out, you know, what he needed, what he didn't need, or did you just kind of come in like, okay, I've got what it takes?
I think, you know, what people don't really realize about working in the White House, especially at the very beginning, is there's no like instruction manual. There's no job description. There's no one to say, here's, you know, how to turn on your computer and work your phone, and this is the number you call for this. Like, it's literally like you have to figure it out for yourself. And President Trump, you know, obviously has been incredibly successful in his life, and so he is set in his ways. And I was really lucky to be able to learn from people like Hope Hicks and Dan Scavino and Jared and Ivanka. And so the first couple months I really did kind of just take a back seat and just do my job, but kind of watch and listen and learn, you know, what he likes, how he operates. And then, you know, the next couple of months, so maybe around, I don't know, May, I was definitely feeling a little bit more comfortable and taking initiative and walking into the Oval to, you know, to give him a document or let him know the meeting needed to wrap. But he was very, very, always very kind and never really, the only times he really ever like got frustrated with me was when I either didn't let him know right away that someone had called or when I had kept someone waiting, you know, for too long. If he had had a meeting at 12:30, and the meeting went from 12:30 to 1:30, and he was supposed to have another meeting at 1:15, and this person had been waiting in the lobby, you know, he'd be like, Madeline, why didn't you tell me they were waiting? I don't want to keep anyone waiting. I'm like, sir, you're the president. I think they will be fine with waiting 10 minutes to see you. But he was very, very cautious and respectful of other people's time. And so that's really the only times when he would get frustrated with me.
So, look, there was there have been books, reports. I'm sure a lot of it's fake news, but that it was total chaos in the West Wing. That, you know, he's a wild man. He's yelling his head off. There's all kinds of drama between Kelly and Priebus. No, Kelly isn't even there yet. Priebus and this, that, and the other. And was it? What was the atmosphere like? I mean, what was it? Was it as chaotic as they say? Was it chaotic in a different way?
It was definitely not as chaotic as they say. And, you know, people always ask me, you know, what was it like working in the White House? And I know they want me to say it was chaotic, but it wasn't. It was chaotic in the sense that we were trying to run a government and everything was very high stakes and everything was important and we couldn't mess this up. And so it was chaotic in the sense of that there was so much going on and, you know, it was a lot. But there was some degree of drama. You know, I think in any time you get more than two people together, yeah, there's going to be some drama. That's kind of normal. But like I grew really close to a lot of the people that I worked with. Hope Hicks became a mentor to me. She was, you know, she was on the campaign. I was an RNC person. I became really, really close friends with John McEntee. He was on the campaign. I was an RNC person. And so, you know, just the reports of all of the drama and infighting are just way overdone.
I had a feeling. I had a feeling. I really, no, it's just that, and of course, reporters, you know, they don't like policy. So, and they can understand personalities and, and it's just easier to write about that stuff, but it's not important. And a lot of it probably isn't true. So,
well, and also I think just if I could say this, you know, I think there is that level of chaos and drama in every White House, but for some reason, the press just loved to write about the Trump White House and the Trump drama. Like, I guarantee you there were challenges in the Bush White House and Obama White House and Biden White House. Like, it's you can't run an organization without some challenges. And so everything was just heightened because it was Trump and the press hated him.
Did you get to the point where, you know, you could be in the same room with him and not be like in awe that this became your boss? And yes, this was the White House, but it started to seem, you know, kind of normal. And you could look at him like and not be freaked out. I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, actually, because that was, you know, I couldn't do my job successfully if I walked into the room and was in awe of him every time. You know, yes, walking into the Oval Office every single day, walking into the Oval Office is incredible. When you have to, when you do it every single day, and that's your office, and that's my boss. And you know, if I had been in awe or scared or, you know, whatever, I wouldn't have been able to be successful in supporting him. And so, yeah, I definitely got to the point where I had no problem walking into the Oval and pass him a note that said, you know, we need to wrap this up, or calling him after, you know, he'd already gone up to the residence and letting him know that we had something scheduled for the next day. It just, as crazy as it sounds, and it still sounds crazy every time I say it, like, he was my boss, and we had this rhythm that worked.
So, by the way, like, you're living somewhere in Washington, D.C. Like, what's your life like at this point? Are you single? Are you married? Are you dating? And, like, are you doing the things that a young professional in Washington would do, yet they worked at the White House?
Yeah, so I lived right across the street from the White House, in the Woodward building. So on 15th Street. So I could walk to work, which was fantastic, because there were a lot of times when I'd get a call from, you know, the Secret Service or the butlers that the president was in the Oval. I'm like, why? It's Sunday. But yeah, I started out single. And then in the summer of 2017, I actually met a young man at the White House. We were walking in the opposite direction along the West Wing colonnade right by the Rose Garden, and stopped and were introduced. And he was working at the Pentagon. He was a former Marine officer, and we hit it off, and we started dating, and dated the rest of the time that I was in the White House. We have since broken up, but yeah, I definitely feel like I was able to have a somewhat like normal and fun life, but I also was really close with a lot of my colleagues. And so we all understood each other, and it was really nice having a significant other at the time that also understood what my life was like. You know, he worked at the Pentagon, I worked at the White House. There was no trying to like needing to explain to him why I said I was going to be home at 7. I didn't get home till 10. Like, he got it. And so that was nice.
Oh, well, what a power couple. I mean, that's, so, oh, wait. What was that one? Oh, yes. There was a moment, I don't think this was you, but it might have been you, where Jim Acosta holds the microphone. Was that you?
Oh, so that wasn't me. That was an intern whose name was also Madeline. And we both have brown hair. And everyone was like, that's Madeline Westerhout. I'm like, it's actually not.
Okay.
We just both happen to have the same unique name.
So, and let's see. I want to ask you about this. Now, again, I do not know Katie Walsh. I do not know Reince Priebus. But there are a lot of folks in MAGA circles who do not trust Katie Walsh. They think that she was out to sabotage the president, and that there were people in the White House who, you know, did not want to carry out his agenda and wanted to thwart him. And, you know, this is a guy who doesn't understand government. We got to protect the institutions. And can you talk about that a little bit? You have thoughts on that?
Katie was an incredible asset to President Trump. And, you know, I was with her for 4 years. I know her character and I know how hard she works and I know how smart she is. And what she did for the RNC in the campaign is really incredible. It's tough because Katie was a really great boss and mentor to me, and I wouldn't be where I was without her. And so those stories were challenging. And then, you know, she left the White House in, I think, February or March. And at that point, you know, the president was my boss. And so I had to choose sides, because that's not an accurate or a fair analysis. But, you know, my priority became the president. And so my friendship with someone like Katie was fractured because I chose the president and he became the most important thing. And that's kind of what you have to do I think that happens a lot in politics and in any business, but really in DC is you have to kind of choose who you're going to align yourself with. And I made the very strategic decision to align myself with Donald Trump and the family and the MAGA people.
Well, I mean, yeah, it kind of made sense. I mean, you're a government employee, by the way, at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You're not working.
Yeah.
You're not an RNC, and
right.
You're working for America. So,
yep.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, look, what about when Reince left? Was that tough for you? And it goes back to the chaos question that people ask. You know, and it had to be tough for Reince. He only made it a few months.
Yeah, that was tough. But at that point too, I wanted what was best for the president. And it was clear that at that time a change needed to be made. And I think I really believe that any first chief of staff to President Trump would have had a difficult time because he is so unique, and it was a learning curve. And so the way that Reince was running the White House worked for a couple months, and then it didn't work. And then the president wanted more structure. And so we had John Kelly, and that really worked for a couple months, and then it didn't work. And so I don't think, you know, the change in chiefs of staff necessarily has as much to do with the individual as just like, we're all trying to learn what works for the president, what works for the staff, and how we can be most successful.
Why didn't it work for John Kelly?
John Kelly was trying to run a Marine battalion. I really, really liked General Kelly. He was one of the people that I met during the transition. And I feel like I had a really special relationship with him, and he was a great boss. But there was no room there was no room for change in the schedule. And he was very set in his ways, and the president is very kind of fluid and wants to change things at last minute and add people to meetings. And General Kelly knew he was brought in to get everything back in line and tighten things up. But as time went on, it was just clear that it wasn't working. And the president really wanted kind of a more fluid, more fluid environment. And honestly, in my opinion, the president was his own best chief of staff. He was his own best press secretary. He's his own best chief of staff.
Do you have like this weird, not weird, sorry, but you have this proximity to the president. You are the his assistant. I mean, his top person, it seems like. You have authority. I mean, you have 4-star generals retired, but even actually active duty kind of coming mm-hmm. to check with you and, you know, is this okay? Is that okay? Did you notice that? What was that like? Is there the danger that it can go to your head a little bit? My sense is that obviously didn't go to yours, but there is that potential, right?
Oh, I talk about this in my book, but it absolutely went to my head. And it is not something that I am proud of. It is something that is really difficult for me to kind of rationalize now that I'm out of it. But yeah, are you kidding? I mean, I was 27 years old and I had cabinet secretaries and foreign leaders and state officials, you know, answering my phone call, and the president listened to my advice on little things, like, you know, nothing big like policy, but yeah, it absolutely went to my head. And I think that is something that was very difficult to kind of rationalize once I left. Did I treat people poorly? Was I not as kind as I could have been? And in the moment, you know, my job and my thought process was, I will do whatever I have to do to protect the president. And now looking back, I realize I could have done that with a lot more kindness.
So in the West Wing, there are always a lot of young people. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are. And sometimes the chief of staff is even very young. We've had 30-year-old, mm-hmm. you know. Do you think with your experience now, looking back, that and what you just said about it going to your head, that there should be older people, that you should kind of live more life before you get such a sensitive job?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think that that is something that people are having challenges with right now after leaving the Trump White House, is that these, you know, late 20s, early 30s individuals were given these crazy, cool and, you know, prestigious titles in the government. And now they expect in the private sector to be, you know, a senior level person in a company. And it just doesn't really work like that. But I believe that the president did surround himself with a good mix of people who had some really fantastic life experience, in many different ways. You know, he had a lot of successful business people as some of his senior advisors. He had a lot of political operatives, and he also had a lot of young, vibrant, energetic, not kids, but young adults. And I think I'm acutely aware of the fact that in any other administration, you know, I don't think I would have been given that opportunity, because there would have been, you know, more infrastructure and staff and, you know, previous kind of structure already in place. But the president, he challenged me. He supported me. He definitely allowed me to grow and gave me opportunities. And, you know, one time I went and straight up asked him for a job, for a promotion, because I was told no by somebody else. And a few women in the White House, Kellyanne, Sarah Sanders, and Ivanka, gave me the advice of just going directly to him and walking into the Oval Office and asking your boss, or walking into the office and asking your boss for a promotion is definitely nerve-wracking walking into the Oval Office and asking the President of the United States for a promotion was really nerve-wracking, and it could have gone one of two ways. But luckily, he was very gracious and, you know, gave me the promotion. But yeah, he, like I said, you know, he surrounded himself with really intelligent people and also really strong, really strong women too. Lots of strong women in the West Wing and in the administration.
I want to come back to this. But did you? What are you trying to do now? You mentioned, and I know exactly what you're talking about. They come out with these, you know, like these top jobs in government, and forgetting that it's Trump for a moment. And let's face it, for some people, for some employers, Trump on your resume is not a good thing. And
yeah.
I think it's totally unfair, but there's a stigma potentially there. But anyway, beyond the book, I have to jump ahead and ask this, but what is your plan?
So I actually just accepted a job this week. And so I am starting a new job and a new career on June 1st. So I was very fortunate to be able to take the time that I needed to kind of decompress after leaving the White House, not on my terms. So, you know, I spent about 6 months writing the book and then a few months doing, you know, speeches and book tour stuff. And then I was, you know, really fortunate to just kind of like lay low for a while and relax and kind of think about what I wanted my life to look like. And that is something that has been really important to me. I moved home to Orange County in November, and I've really looked at kind of the next steps more holistically than just what I want my career to be. I just think about what do I want my life to look like? And I want to have a balanced life. I want to be close to my family. I want to enjoy what I'm doing. And so I'm starting a job in a couple of weeks with a creative like branding company, which is totally different, not political, and I'm really excited.
Very cool. Hey, did you talk to any previous White House secretaries, you know, like, or assistants who had your job in previous administrations? No.
No. One of President Bush's assistants, Ashley Marquis, worked in the Trump White House, and so we chatted a couple of times. Mostly, honestly, just like in the hallway about how things were going. But no, I never spoke to Obama's assistant. Yeah, there was no overlap there.
Can you tell us, did you ever get to see the residence? Hardly anybody ever gets to go up there in the, you know, from the general public. I was in one room once, the yellow room or?
Yeah, the yellow oval.
Yeah. What's it like up there? Have you been there?
I have, yeah. And I, you know, Mrs. Trump is very private. And I think she did a really good job of making it clear to staff that the private residence is exactly that, the private residence. And much to the dismay of Mrs. Trump, President Trump loved to bring people up there. And, you know, the amount of times when he would be in a meeting and he'd say, let's go tour the residence. And then I have to quickly call up, say, Mrs. Trump, your husband is bringing about 20 people through your home right now. but yeah, I did go up there a few times and it's beautiful. I never went into any of the bedrooms, but yeah, went into the yellow oval, the treaty room, the Lincoln bedroom, which is just used as a guest room. But I did try to respect that private space.
When Trump gets there, when President Trump becomes president, I noticed that he did not seem to be particularly in awe of the job or of the trappings. And I came up with this theory is that, well, he's been famous for a very long time. He already had his own plane. He already had some of the trappings of a president. And I guess there was a report or two that he grumbled about the condition of the White House. Did he seem in awe? Did he seem ever like to be, gee whiz, you know, I'm the president and I'm in the White House? Or is it more like I observe from up here?
So that's so funny. And I've heard that several times. The president was always in awe. I mean, he knew exactly how fortunate he was to be in that position. And it's funny because the amount of times that he said to people like myself and Dan Scavino and John McEntee, like, hey, come into the Oval Office. Let's pause and look where we are. Like, look around. We're in the White House. We're in the Oval Office. And so it's always funny to me when people say, oh, he made comments about the White House being, a dump, or he didn't like being president or anything. Like, that is not at all what I witnessed. I witnessed someone who was in awe of everything about the presidency. And I remember the first time Marine One landed on the South Lawn, and he was in the Oval and I was in the outer Oval, and I just watched him watch Marine One land. And there was absolutely so much respect and amazement for where he was.
Did you have a relationship with any reporters?
I did not. No, I really never interacted with reporters unless the president asked me to, call someone and tell them to come into the Oval or relay a message or get someone on the phone. But yeah, no, it's ironic because the reason I left the White House was due to an unfortunate incident with reporters, but that was the first and only time I ever interacted with reporters, really.
I do remember, I thought it was your name, and I could be wrong, but on one of the tapes in Bob Woodward's,
Oh, right.
New mm-hmm. first book.
Yeah,
Madeline, they talk about you, right? You should have
called
Madeline.
Because I guess Mr. Woodward had been trying to get a hold of the president for an interview for his book, but wasn't able to. And so the president called Bob and said, why don't you talk to me? And he said, I think, I talked to so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. And the president said something along the lines of like, well, you have to talk to Madeline. She's the key.
Do you have any impressions of those books that were written? Did you read them?
No, definitely not. Yeah, I actually wrote an op-ed for Town Hall a couple months ago about all these books. And you really have to look at the motives behind a lot of these books. And, I never thought I'd write a book. And I never wanted to be just another person who writes a tell-all. But for me, my book was personal and, more cathartic. So I needed to write it for my own well-being. But yeah, I mean, so many of these books are not sourced. They're sourced by people that really have no interaction or knowledge of the president at all. And they're selling out, the advances on someone like John Bolton's book was a lot. It was a heck of a lot more than I made on my book. That's for sure.
So before I ask you and we talk about your departure and all that stuff, from my perspective up here, 2 years ago, not thinking I would ever talk to you, I just thought it was handled as well as it could be by both of you.
There
was something
that.
Honest and genuine about, your statement and what he said. I just, mm-hmm. It was, and then when I saw later that he tweeted something nice about the book or, was encouraging, I just thought, there's something, there's something very human. And actually, it's funny, I just got a text message from somebody else who was fired by Donald Trump. 30 years ago. It's just so mm-hmm. strange that I got a message. But anyway, so what happened?
I went to a dinner with some reporters, drank too much, and said some things I shouldn't have said. I mean, that's about it. And of course, I wish I could take that back. I absolutely hate the fact that I hurt people that I care about. I mean, I became very, very close with the family. And I messed up. And there's really no other way around it.
Who were the reporters? I know this has been out there. I mean, but can you say who they were?
The reporters were Phil Rucker from The Washington Post, Andrew Rustakia from Wall Street Journal, Jennifer Jacobs from Bloomberg, and Steve Holland from Reuters.
So you said this in their presence.
Yes.
I mean, and they, what happened then? I guess you didn't say this is off the record, or wasn't it under?
No, it was made very, very, very clear that this dinner was off the record.
It was.
Oh, yeah. And so Hogan Gidley, who was the deputy press secretary, is the one who invited me to this dinner. And he, once we got to dinner, he left to go do a live hit with Judge Jeanine. And so I was with these four reporters for like over an hour, and was by myself, and they just started asking questions. And in my own twisted way, I really thought that I was humanizing the family and like and sharing things. First of all, sharing things that I not, should not have shared, I will admit that. But just sharing like human stories, you know, like this is a normal family, and they go through things just like we all do. And I thought that I was kind of just trying to humanize them, and you know, they took things out of context, and they reported on an off the record dinner.
Where was the dinner?
It was in Bedminster.
And like, obviously they totally betrayed you. Did they each one write a story?
No. So, you know, and I talk about this in the book, and I honestly don't know what happened, and I have just kind of decided like I could spend the rest of my life trying to figure out exactly what happened, and it's just not really worth it to me. But you know, there's different versions of what happened depending on who you ask, and some you know, some people I think say that the reporters shared with Hogan what I said to make him aware of what had been said. And then that Hogan started telling other West Wing staffers, and then it got back to the press. There's some stories that, you know, Phil Rucker told other reporters. And so honestly, I don't know exactly what happened,
How did you
but
find
it got out.
it got out? It got out. And
Yeah.
then what happened? And I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Are you okay talking about this for 2 more minutes? Yeah.
For
So,
sure.
what happened? I mean, how were you? You were obviously caught. Like, what did that
Yeah.
look like? Who called you in? What happened?
I had a planned vacation back home to California, because the Bedminster trip was the president's vacation, and a lot of the staff took vacation time during that trip. And I this like this is always what gets me too. I really wanted to go on that trip. And I was so adamant that I get to go on that trip. And now I'm like, oh my gosh, I just should have taken vacation with everybody else. But when we got back to the White House the next week, I had a planned week-long vacation at home in California. And I think it was a couple of days into my vacation that Mick Mulvaney called me and said, "Yeah, I heard about this dinner. I've spoken to the president, and we can't have you come back to work." And I was obviously shocked and devastated and just, you know, completely crushed, because I loved my job. But I remember having conversations with some of the senior staff about, you know, we're going to make sure that this doesn't get out, right? Like, we're going to just tell the story is just going to be that Madeline resigned. And yes, that of course we don't want this getting out. And then Maggie Haberman emailed me and said she's going to run a story in an hour. Do I have a comment? And then that was just another level of absolute devastation, and having to read about it and read about what I supposedly said. And yeah, that was very challenging. But I was able to speak to the president the day after I was asked to resign, and I apologized to him. And the amount of grace that he showed me is still something that I'm so thankful for. He was absolutely fantastic, and you know, he said he forgave me, and it, you know, he forgave me right then. I don't think I forgave myself for another 6 to 9 months. But I was able to kind of, you know, make sure that relationship stayed as intact as it could, given the circumstances.
So, I'm sorry you went through this. This is tough stuff. So, what you leave the White House, it's got to be culture shock all over again. What you said it took 6 to 9 months to kind of bounce back, but like practically speaking, what did you do? Where did you go? And how did you take care of yourself?
I flew back to DC.
It happened in Bedminster. So all this went down in Bedminster.
No. So the dinner happened in Bedminster. I went home to California the next week.
Okay.
And Nick called me while I was in California. And so then I stayed in California about another week and then flew back to DC because my boyfriend at the time, we lived together and he wanted me to come back. And our apartment building was right across the street from the White House, which was incredibly convenient for the 2.5 years that I worked there. And then incredibly devastating when I didn't work there because I couldn't walk out of my apartment without seeing my former place of work.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the first couple weeks, honestly, I was really depressed. It was really challenging. I was very, very upset and mad at myself. I honestly thought that I had ruined my life and I was never going to get another job and that this had just ruined my life. And so it took me a few weeks to kind of even, you know, be okay. And then my boyfriend, now my ex-boyfriend, is the one who said, you know, why don't you think about writing a book? And I was like, goodness, I can't even imagine writing a book. That's the last thing I want to do. But I also couldn't think about really moving on in any other way. I knew if I got a new job, this would still be something like unresolved trauma. And so I ended up, you know, signing a contract for my book, and writing the book was incredibly cathartic. It was really, really helpful to kind of move forward, but also really fantastic to be able to remember and document the most incredible experience that I will ever have and write about, you know, the man that I got to know and share with the American people, you know, a different side of him. And now I'll always have that. And I'm very proud of it.
Yeah. Wow. Who was your publisher?
My publisher was Hachette Book Group.
Was there?
They've done Spicer's book and.
Any pressure, you know, initially to discussion, like, okay, you know, where's the juicy stuff, you know?
No, not at all. Yeah. So there were a couple of reports like right after I left that, you know, Madeline Westerhout could make millions off of a tell-all. And I said, there's not enough money in the world for me to write a tell-all because it would be lies. You know, I don't have a tell-all. I have my tell-all that I had a great experience. And so when I remember meeting with my agent and telling him kind of my idea for the book, and he was like, all right, well, that's about 75% of publishers that we can take off the table because they won't even want to meet with you. but yeah, no, not at all. There was no pressure to write any sort of juicy tell-all. My publisher and my editor, they were great. And they allowed me to write what I wanted to write.
Do you think President Trump can come back? Do you think he will come back? Do you think do you think he's going to run again?
That's a great question. And you know, honestly, there's three and a half years is a long time. And so we'll just kind of have to see. But what I do know is that he's not going anywhere. You know, even if he doesn't run again, he is such a staple of the party now. And I don't see him ever just kind of slipping away into the ether. Like, I think he will always be involved in some capacity.
Do you think he could be a lot more effective next time in that, look, there's a lot of stuff he didn't know about the swamp, mm-hmm. about the deep state, and that stuff
yeah.
is real. And I just feel like he would have a much better handle on things, and particularly with staffing. I mean, you know, he knows what
yeah.
he wants now, and it could
yeah.
be pretty awesome. Last thing, and I do like to know this about people I talk to and on podcasts and off podcasts, but and if you care sharing, terrific. But are you a person of faith? And can you, if you are, did that help you through any of this? What are your thoughts on faith?
I love that you asked me that. I've always considered myself a Christian, but it wasn't until after I left the White House that I really reconnected with my faith. And honestly, it has been life-changing. I don't think I could have gotten through what I went through without my faith. And I am so thankful that I was able to rebuild, you know, my relationship with Christ. I am, you know, I attend church every Sunday. I'm the co-leader of my life group. I volunteer in several different capacities at my church. And it honestly has become the most important thing to me. And while I wish that things hadn't played out as they did, I am so thankful that it brought me home, both home to California and home in Christ. So, yeah.
I love it. I mean, that's, I think it was all worth it. I know exactly what you're saying. And trials sometimes do that. And I've had a different journey from yours, but very similar at the same time. Well, I really enjoyed talking to you. It's a fascinating story. And thank you very, very much. Let me just see if there's anything else. Are you going to do, once you start with this new position, is that like it for the book? Are you kind of closing the door on this chapter and not looking, well, you'll always look back, but I mean, you know what I mean? Like, is this going to be, are you not going to talk about the book, or would you be doing any media going forward? Do you have an agreement with the employer to like, okay, that stuff is over?
No type of agreement like that. My employer, he's not political at all. Honestly, we didn't really even talk about how I left my last job or anything like that. And so I definitely, I do love sharing my story, and I love sharing, you know, really the man that I got to know. And I think it's important. And so, no, I'm absolutely not going to be done with the book or done talking about politics, but I am looking forward and, you know, kind of not dwelling on the past, but really will happily share my experience and my story anytime, because I do believe that, you know, I was incredibly fortunate to have had one of the coolest jobs in the world. But also trials and tribulations are real, and that's where we grow and learn. And so if by sharing my story, you know, I can give insight to an up and coming politico or a young woman, like, you know, honestly, I would love that opportunity.
And would you ever, you're not ruling out working in politics again?
I'm not ruling it out. I think I really needed to get out of DC, get out of that world, just kind of like recalibrate, you know? And so, yeah, no, not ruling anything out.
Well, I think she's great. And I hope she goes back into politics, maybe someday, whatever happens. I think it's going to be awesome. I'm very impressed with her, what she did, that she learned so much. And again, the book, which I am, my new thing is not downloading books. I go to the bookstore. I go to Barnes & Noble in New York City, and I'm buying the hardcovers. I'm sick of downloading books and not reading them. Whenever I buy a hard copy, I read it. So her book, again, is called Off the Record, My Dream Job at the White House, How I Lost It, and What I Learned. Madeline Westerhout, we're very, very appreciative. And thank you for liking this podcast, downloading it, streaming it, however that works, and rating it. And I'll see you hopefully on the Newsmax show. In the meantime, all the best. And we can have a slightly deranged conversation over social media. My handle is @GregKellyUSA, @GregKellyUSA. Take care.